younger than, and I needed a thrill. She rolled on in with a rusty old truck, and I knew right away that I was in love.
Happy New Year! I hope you all had a wonderful 2022 and are excited for a new year ahead. Welcome back to the Voices of the Lake podcast series, where we dive into some awesome local initiatives that aim to protect Kootenai Lake's watershed. I'm your host, Joelle Burney, broadcasting from the shores of Kootenai Lake, the ancestral home of the Yakiniki Band of the Tanaha Nation. We also acknowledge the other Tanaha bands in addition to the Sinaiks, Shwepnik, and Seals First Nations, who have territories and ancestral lands upstreams and downstream of Kootenai Lake. The song in this episode is The River by Born on a Wednesday. You can hear more music from Born on a Wednesday on Spotify, Bandcamp, or visit their website, bornonawednesday.com. You can also follow them on Instagram, Born on a Wednesday Music. Thanks, guys. We love your stuff and appreciate your contribution to our podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by the Regional District of Central Kootenai and Fortis, BC. Today we are chatting with Eric Leslie, a forestry consultant and manager of the Harrop Proctor Community Forest near Nelson, BC. He has worked with community organizations, forest industry, indigenous peoples, and regional and provincial governments on projects from Haida-Gwaii to Labrador. Eric has extensive experience in forestry planning and operations, community engagement, and small business management. For the past decade, Eric's work has focused on community-based strategies to address climate change and reduce wildfire risks. My conversation with Eric was really interesting. We dove into what the Harrop Proctor Community Forest Co-op is all about, its history, the sustainable forest practices they use, the important ecosystem characteristics they consider before harvesting, how they maintain a business while protecting the surrounding watershed, and the work they are doing around climate change adaptation. One of the coolest things I learned about the co-op is its main goals are to protect the watershed and provide local jobs within the community, with the added benefit of operating a small mill that supports our local economy in a sustainable way. But the environment and community are at the heart of this cooperative, which is such a neat alternative approach to small-scale forestry. I hope you all enjoy this episode, and let's get into it. Hello, Eric. Welcome to the Voices of the Lake podcast series. Thanks so much for coming on. We're really excited to have you. You're joining us from the Harrop Proctor Community Co-op. We're going to learn more about that organization today, and I'm really, really excited. So to get started, you know, it's the end of the year. I've been reminiscing a lot about some of my favorite moments that I've spent on Kootenai Lake this year, and I'm curious to know what your favorite adventure you've had on Kootenai Lake this past year has been.
Oh, well, yeah. Great to be here. Thanks, Joelle. I swim a lot in the summer. And I had some great swims this year. I swim out in Proctor as much as I can. That's a general activity. On Canada Day weekend, we went over to Pilot Point and camped over there, or Pilot Bay. And that was really awesome. Great weather. And
nice.
Had a great time on the lake.
Yeah. Nice. I've never been to Pilot Bay, but I've always wanted to go. So that's definitely on my list for next year. And how about you start off by sharing a little bit about you and what you do?
Okay. So I am a forestry consultant, and I work for the Harrop Proctor Community Forest, or Harrop Proctor Community Cooperative. And I live in Nelson, and I've lived here for about 22 years.
Wow.
Raised my family here, and I love it here. And I've lived in other places and chose Nelson, like many others.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy a lot of the things that folks around this area enjoy, not just the swimming, but the the skiing and being on the water in the summer, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and kind of what inspired you to want to work for the Harrop Proctor Community Forest Co-op?
I got into forestry through an interest in environmental issues and environmental ethics and philosophy kind of things when I was in my early 20s. And I decided fairly early on that the reason, in fact, I got into forestry specifically was that it was a concrete, tangible practice and suite of issues that takes place on a very specific land base. And I wanted to have a role to play in that. So that's how I got into forestry in the first place. And that's highly relevant to why I chose to work for Proctor Community Forest. I did a number of things before I worked for the community forest, but I have worked for the community forest now for 16 plus years. And so the reason I chose to work for the community forest is it's a group of local people who I work for, who would like to manage the land in their backyard in a way that feels right to them, and especially around protecting their water and watersheds, which resonates with me.
Yeah.
While at the same time running a small business and doing it as an enterprise. It's a social enterprise, but it's a business enterprise at the same time. And that's very real and concrete for me. Yeah. So I like the effort to connect broad principles and ideals with actions on the ground. So that's sort of where I like to work, is in that space.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's such an interesting balance too, between like having a business, but then you're also doing like almost stewardship work in a way. So that's really interesting. And how did this cooperative come about? Like, why was it really created?
So the community forest grew out of the war in the woods in the 1980s and 1990s, the time of conflict between, generally speaking, pro-logging and anti-logging forces. Mm-hmm. And at that time, before the community forest was created, there were proposals for logging in the Harrop area, and there were blockades, and a lot of the community was quite upset about what was planned in the watershed. And that created some space, I think, politically and socially for what came next. They're actually, the original plan for many of the locals was to try to have a park created in their watershed. Okay. This was before West Arm Park was created. West Arm Park was created in the early to mid-90s, I think. And it protected Nelson's watershed and a bunch of other area, but it actually excluded the Harrop-Proctor watersheds, which was not what a bunch of the locals wanted. Although a bunch of the locals also work in the forest industry, so let's not forget it's a vast and complicated or complex community. So that sort of phase one was advocating for a park. Phase two was a pilot program created in the late 90s by the NDP government at the time, called the Community Forest Pilot Program, and communities were invited to apply for a community forest, which was an unknown entity at that point, didn't exist. Anyway, long story short, a lot of the folks who advocated for a park and didn't get one decided, well, let's try to manage this land ourselves.
Wow.
And put in a 3-inch binder with the business plan and the management plan and letters of support and all that stuff. And we're one of the few communities who were successful in getting one of those first rounds of community forests in the province. There were 5 or 6 communities who were awarded the chance to manage their own land, and that's how the community forest was created. And that was the community forest started 22 years ago.
Wow.
So since then we've been doing it, and lots has changed over that time, as we may get into as we talk, but that's the backstory.
Wow, that's incredible. And how many people would you say are kind of part of this community in total?
So Harrop and Proctor is about 600 to 800 people. It's an, you know, it's an unincorporated rural area, part of RDCK Area E. Mm-hmm. It's very easily defined, of course, because everyone takes the same ferry to get home. The number of members, so there's maybe 250 households or maybe 300 households. The majority of those households are members of the co-op. I think over 200 people are members of the co-op and own for $25 a share in the cooperative. So that's how many people are involved as the people to whom I report through the board of directors and the people for whom forestry potentially matters. Those are how many people drink out of the watersheds there.
Right.
There's a board of directors of about a dozen people who are elected from the local folks. So that's the, how the organization is structured.
Cool. Awesome. And can you kind of provide a sense of scale of the harvesting that you guys do? So firstly, how big is the forest that you're managing? And then how much do you cut annually, would you say?
The area of the community forest, and it's all public land. Mm-hmm. It's 11,300 hectares, and it runs from the upper edge of the private land that runs along the lake up to the Haida land.
Okay.
So it's the Harrop Creek, Slater Creek, Narrows Creek, Proctor Creek, and Irvine Creek watersheds, and a few face drainages. So it that might sound kind of big, but it's not very big in the context of even Kootenai Lake or
right.
Let alone the larger province, but it's considered a small tenure, but it has the benefit of being entire watersheds, which mm-hmm. is great. And the amount that we cut currently is 10,000 cubic meters. It's about 50 cubic meters on a logging truck for reference. So that's 200 or just over 200 logging truck loads a year, which again is considered very small. Mm-hmm. In the context of the forest industry, but it's enough to run our community forest. Now, I'm the whole forestry department. So realizing we also have a sawmill and we employ 7 or 8 people down at the sawmill. They mill a portion of the wood that comes off our hillside. So that's the business is also that. But as far as the forestry operation, I'm actually about just over half time on the whole forestry department, which is neat because I get to do everything from higher level planning and working mm-hmm. with the community and the board, business planning, forest, then more into the forestry, planning and layout and supervision of operations, hiring contractors, tree planting and silviculture, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you get to do a whole variety of things. That's kind of nice about, smaller like nonprofit or community run organizations where there's, a small number of staff and you get to do a lot of different things. And you also get to build really tight relationships with different members of the community, which is really cool. And what's kind of like the main vision or the goal of the cooperative?
The main vision and the goal comes directly from the history that I outlined a few minutes ago mm-hmm. around a watershed advocacy and protection issues. So the number one management goal is to protect drinking water and watersheds more generally, and the suite of environmental issues and values that are connected with that. Now, how that's done is another matter. We can talk about that later. The second mandate is around creating sustainable local jobs. So local employment in the community is also a big part of the reason that our community forest exists.
Nice.
But it's secondary to the land management ethic.
Right. Awesome. You talked more about like the memberships involved in the cooperative. So what's the community's role really in managing this cooperative? So as a member, what's kind of their job?
So the co-op holds the license. Mm-hmm. So that's the mechanism. And the co-op obviously is made up of its members. Yeah. As one member, one vote. So the members can be as involved as they would like to. They can sit on the board and represent the community forest at the highest level. Mm-hmm. They can sit on committees. They can come to meetings and social events that we organize. There's lots of ways to get involved more generally. Certainly, there's lots of direct one-to-one discussions between myself and community members around their interests or concerns. Like someone has a little walking trail in behind their place that a couple of the neighbors use, and there's lots of discussions around things like that are informal parts of the forestry work that we do, things that aren't on maps and aren't legally recognized. Mm-hmm. But the main structural way in which the community is involved is they own the business.
Right.
So it's, that's,
yeah.
So everything, you have to always remember that. I certainly have to always remember.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting. That's such a such a cool approach to like forestry. And I like too, how before you're talking about like, in terms of the visions and goals. Number one is like to protect the watershed, not to, you know, make money off of the logging products. It's the environment and the people, which I think is so important and such a cool alternative way of a business, essentially.
And we're just on that note, like, because it's an important point. We do try to make some money.
And yeah, for sure.
We're not for profit. No, but yeah. we're not for profit, though. So the goal is not profit. Mm-hmm. The goal is land management and jobs.
Yeah.
At the same time, we have to run a viable business. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't always been easy. Luckily, right. Timber is worth money, mm-hmm. either as logs or lumber. And it's currently, as we run things, enough money to pay for the expenses of doing the work. But right. we have to always remember that we're leveraging one value in the forest, which is the timber, yeah. to manage for and protect the all the other values, including, you know, recreation, aesthetic values, drinking water, of course, and everything else. So we're essentially using one value in the forest to pay for the management of all the values.
Right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the sustainable forest practices that you guys use. So one really interesting approach you use is ecosystem-based planning. Can you maybe share what that is and kind of what that looks like?
Sure. Ecosystem-based planning can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people and has evolved over the years. When it was first being used by the community forest, it referred very specifically to taking a precautionary approach to forest management that focuses on, like I was saying earlier, all the ecosystem values, the limits of the ecosystem, the character of the ecosystem, and starts there. Mm-hmm. And one of the outputs of that work can be timber, but you start with the ecosystem.
Right.
And I'll sort of fast forward a little bit to current day, where we're still using the same methodology or the same goals. The methods to achieve the ecosystem-based approaches have to evolve as we understand the watershed differently over the decades. Specifically, I'm talking about climate change and yeah. fire regimes. And we could talk more about that a little bit later, but mm-hmm. in case we don't, so when we look at a changing climate, we have to look at forest in the context of what's going on with their ecosystems as they change and how that would affect our management. So, and just to be a little more concrete, the management that we use focuses on all the areas that should be reserved from commercial harvest first, and then the areas that are safe to work in are sort of residual to that.
Okay.
And within the areas where we work, we also look at what are the important trees and areas and special sites to protect within that.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's kind of, you've already covered this question, but kind of before you're going in to do a harvest, you know, what are some things that you take into consideration? Are there any like very specific types of things that you go over before you're like, okay, this particular area can be harvested?
There's quite a list.
Yeah.
Quite a list. I would sort of split it into sort of landscape and watershed considerations and then site level considerations.
Okay. Yeah.
You don't just go look at a stand or a 5 or 10 hectares or 50 acres or whatever and say, what can we do here? We start with the watershed and its location, its elevation, how it relates to flows in the creek, how it relates to potential fuel breaks, all those sorts of things. And so we look at it in the context of how much change has there been in the watershed recently. For example, we had a big fire in 2017. It burned a large portion of the headwaters of Harrop Creek. So logging more of the headwaters of Harrop Creek, well, we've never logged in the headwaters of Harrop Creek. If we, you know, were considering it in the short term and medium term, it would not be a good idea to be working there because we already had a bunch of that forest burned.
Right.
So it's not a good area to work. However, the low elevations in Harrop Creek are a very different story. They're much drier. They don't contribute the water to the late summer flows. They don't contribute to peak flows. They're a very different part of the hydrology. So that's one. That's a very concrete example of how we look at it generally on a more site level. Of course, we also look at how steep is it? Are there train stability concerns?
Right.
Are there sustainable, like productive soils that will, you know, be productive after we do any work in there, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we also look at, do we have access into that area, and or is it easy to develop access into there, that area, that sort of thing. So we look at all the what you might call constraints or all the reserve considerations. And we also look at, obviously, we also look at, well, is there timber value there and or a fuel management benefit, a welfare risk reduction benefit of doing work in there? And that's how the work proceeds from there.
Okay. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Like, yeah, that all makes
more
sense.
If you want. Okay.
No,
so
yeah.
There's a lot of different things that we look at and looking at, you know, is it caribou habitat? Yes, no.
Yeah.
Is it headwaters of the watershed? Is it unstable terrain? Is it a rare ecosystem? If the answer, you know, to any of those things is yes, well, then we're not going to be going there, at least not in
right
that way.
Yeah. And that kind of stems into my other question. So how do you keep up with the supply and demand? So I was reading online that around, you know, 70% of the community forest isn't suitable for harvesting because it's, you know, too sensitive or has critical habitat, is old growth, etc. And that's a, you know, pretty big percentage. And you were talking about how like the area of the forest isn't actually all that big. So how are you able to keep up with supply and demand throughout the year?
Well, the annual or the average harvest level of 10,000 cubic meters is based on an analysis of the land base, removing all the areas from the land base that we would not work in or not extract timber from. So the 10,000 cubic meters is an output of a planning process, not an input,
okay,
if you will. So it's what we have determined to be the sustainable and appropriate harvest level.
Okay.
It makes us a fairly small player. Mm-hmm. However, it is enough of a harvest level to run a small business on.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not an easy small business to run. And if it was all dead pine or small spruce or something in another part of the province, it wouldn't be enough to run a business on, likely, and not a timber business. Luckily, we do have some higher value species in the mix, and that is what makes it viable from a dollars and cents perspective. So we don't try to meet any specific demand. We take what we have and we run our organization within those parameters, and that includes the supply of logs to our mill as well. The mill couldn't become a large sawmill unless it was depending on more and more and more on other sources of logs. Mm-hmm. To the extent that the logs are coming from our own community forest, the mill can't be very big. It just can't.
Right. And, you know, thinking on things kind of on a larger scale, do you think the structure that you guys are using and these practices could be adapted by, you know, larger forest companies, like ecosystem-based planning? Do you think that can be applied to larger companies?
I think that there are quite a few elements of what we do that can be and sometimes are applied by others. We didn't invent everything.
Right.
However, you have to look at every organization as to what's the ownership, what's the mandate, what's the scope of their work. And if an organization has a mandate to do work like we do and has a land base roughly similar to ours, then there's no reason why the similar principles couldn't be used. Every community in the province is different. There are over 50 community forests. I think there's 60 plus community forests actually in the province, constituting globally altogether only 3% of the forest sector in the province. But there's a lot of them, and including one in the Slocan Valley and one in Creston and one in Caslow and the Cusp and Midway. And every one of them runs a little bit differently. However, the West Kootenai Community Forests have a certain amount of similarity in that we do tend to be pretty tightly community linked and wildfire risk reduction oriented as well. And so I would say that, sure, there are lots of things that we do that other forestry outfits can use and some do use. The ones that are most likely to use them are probably going to be closely tied, I would suggest, to their communities and not huge companies, because scale does matter. However, there are some very specific techniques, like how we do partial cutting, how we do wildfire risk reduction, how we adapt to climate change, and the techniques that we're using. Those are adaptable to other forest areas and other licenses, for sure. And in fact, I am not uncommonly asked by other folks in government or industry to comment on how, you know, how did we do that partial cut in there, and how do we make that work, or how are we doing your wildfire risk reduction or whatever. So, you know, we're part of a sector, we have lots of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So the short answer to your question is yes, there are quite a few. The complex answer is that it depends somewhat on mandate.
So you kind of already covered this a little bit, but let's kind of talk more about protecting the watershed. So for our listeners who, you know, might not know this already, but you have already covered a little bit, how is watershed protection kind of addressed in forestry or in your practices in particular? I was also reading a little bit on your website and how you guys do a bit of like watershed monitoring as well. Is that a practice that you still do?
Yes, we've been monitoring the larger creeks in the community forest for close to 20 years, I think. And when I say monitoring, specifically flow levels, stream levels, and turbidity, and a few other things sometimes. So how clean is the water, and what's the flow regime? Our objective is to not negatively impact the flow regime or the water quality, obviously.
Right. Yeah.
Older forests tend to do a very good job of regulating flows so the peaks aren't too high and the lows aren't too low. And the water is generally fairly clean. So you might think, oh, we'll just stay out of the watersheds and you're fine. And if it wasn't for wildfires and natural disturbances and changing climate, that point would have a lot of merit. We have to realize that there are threats to our water quality and to the timing of flows and risks of floods and running out of water and all those things. And those are actually natural risks, or that are independent of our actions, or at least we didn't cause them directly, although climate change we did. But the creeks here are naturally dynamic. They do flood, many of them, at various times. There are landslides at times. There are wildfires that change the regime for periods of time in our creeks. And we have to work with that complex system, which we don't control. And so our objective is a little more narrow than really managing the water, really, like we manage our role in it. And one of the things that we do is doesn't make people happy, and society generally considers it not to be a good idea if a whole watershed burns up and the creeks turn brown for a couple of even if that were kind of natural. So we do try to do what we can to lower the risk of that happening through fuel breaks and creating opportunities to limit the size of major wildfires. So that's interaction between wildfire and water water is a big complicated one. On the more narrow sense, we look at where the streams are. Obviously, we put reserves on streams. We stay away from unstable slopes. We do all the what I consider to be kind of normal, straightforward, precautionary sort of things around water.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we work on a more proactive basis to look at limiting the risks to watersheds these are largely human related risks, right? The fish don't mind it either, I'm sure, when the water goes brown, but they've dealt with that for thousands of years. They don't like it, presumably, but they somehow figure it out, and people can figure it out too. But we've generally agreed that we don't really want that, so we try to work within those parameters as well.
Nice, cool. And I was reading a little bit too about like the Harrah Proctor Watershed Society and how they were kind of involved in the first steps of like applying for the license. what is their role now with the community forest?
Yeah, good question. And I should have mentioned that at the beginning. The community forest was actually awarded originally to the Hare-Proctor Watershed Protection Society, who did the application originally. And the mandate of this society is watershed protection and environmental issues and education more generally as well. Mm-hmm. The co-op was created after the community forest was created, and to run the business, because a cooperative made more sense mm-hmm. as a way to run it. The watershed continues to exist as a sister organization, and there is a somewhat overlapping mandate. The Watershed Protection Society is in large measure an oversight organization where our practices and planning is under review by the Watershed Protection Society, and their job is to ensure that we don't stray from the principles on which we were founded. So there is actually structured in the co-op's constitution, half of the board members of the co-op have to be members of the watershed. So that, okay. that ensures that the two organizations are always connected through that mechanism, through a governance mechanism.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It's a very tight relationship.
And then too, like how, or are there ways for community members to actively participate in watershed stewardship practices, like either through the co-op or through the like Watershed Society, or even just in general too, just people wanting to take part in protecting their local watersheds? Are there some things that you would suggest?
Well, there's the work of the co-op, and there are quite a few people in the community involved in that work, either as board members or committee members. We also have people who do the within the community who do the water sampling. So mm-hmm. there are people for each creek to collect the water and do some analyses and send water off to the lab as needed. So that's another piece. Mm-hmm. We also have special projects sometime that local folks are involved in. For example, in the Harrop Wetlands Restoration Project. I'm not sure of the proper name for it, but the community forest donated some large woody debris and that sort of thing for that. So we often there's initiatives that happen in the community through other organizations that we might contribute financially or in kind to, whether it's the West Arm Outdoors Club and their fishing wharf or the wetland project or other things like that. So we don't try to do everything ourselves. We try to support other folks and organizations who want to do things themselves as well.
Yeah, I do remember you provided us some materials because we are actually spearheading the Harrop Wetland Restoration Project. So yeah, you guys, I think, provided some stuff with that. So that was really awesome. And helped with restoration efforts in that. So that's really cool. And I also love too how the community can get involved in doing watershed monitoring, because that's a really fun and educational thing that connects people and community members to our watershed. So that's really important. Okay, let's go back kind of to talking about climate change and sort of the future and what that looks like for the cooperative. I know you talked a little bit about this in the beginning and kind of like fire practices that you're implementing in the co-op, but I was also reading too that you're working on a climate change adaptation pilot project for the community forest. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what that looks like?
Yeah, that's a big focus of my work and the community forest's work. We've been working on climate change adaptation issues for over a decade. And a lot of those do revolve around wildfire-related issues, but not just wildfire-related issues. There's also drought issues and broader forest health issues and risk management issues. So we received some funding from Columbia Basin Trust about 5 years ago, and the community forest also put in some money into it to create this project. And the objective of the project is to do a case study or a pilot of how forest management might look if you looked at it systematically through the lens of a changing climate.
Okay, yeah.
So where would you go? What would you do? For example, on our drier sites, you know, we've looked at how dry they're likely to get, how much drier, for example, or our sites that aren't that dry now, but may well become dry, well, will become drier, are becoming drier. We're looking at what tree species and densities are sustainable on those sites. We're looking at what kind of mix of age classes and species might be suitable in a future climate within watersheds. So we're working a lot on diversifying the species and ages and proactively realigning some of our ecosystems with the climate trajectory that we're on. And we have to remember also for context that our forests, we have some old growth forests, but except for the ones that are at the top of the mountain where we wouldn't be going anyways, they tend to be small areas that were missed by the fires of the early 1900s. All the area that we work in is you know, 100 and 120 years old and originated from one or two large fires. So, and then after those fires, which are associated with some dry summers, but also the mining era and the settlement era and the railroads, after those fires, then around the 40s and 50s, we got really good at firefighting and put out fires quite successfully for half a century or more. And that resulted in quite an unnatural forest, actually. Climate change aside, even an unnatural forest in being very uniform, actually, uniformly coniferous and the same age.
Right.
And then you add on top of that climate change, which increases the risk of fire. And we already have a fire deficit, if you will. And it further stresses the forest through drought. And we're really behind the eight ball in terms of the arguably fairly poor resilience of our forests, many of them, to the climate because we suppressed fires and now have a hotter, drier climate. So it really pushes us towards a somewhat more proactive approach on that 30% of the land base that where we do active management. And we really have to look and are looking and are implementing thinning techniques, especially, and moving stands back towards a more semi-open mixed fir larch leading type forest rather than a uniformly dense forest with a lot of cedar hemlock everywhere. Cedar hemlock, for example, you know, they rely on a decent bit of moisture in the soil and they don't respond well to fire, they get killed. Mm. And they're great to have in moist areas and in a lot of different areas, but you don't want to have them everywhere. Or if you do, you're carrying risks of drought and fire. So we're definitely looking at the species mix. So there's a lot of different complicated things to look at that way, but those are all part of the adaptation project. So we look at each site, we look at the drought or the moisture regime on each site, and then through climate change modeling, and then we come up with plans for each of those types of sites for how to interact with the natural dynamics through our forestry operation.
Right. And do you deal, so looking at kind of, we talked a lot about fires and in terms of like flooding, do you look at that kind of similarly as fire management, or is it a completely different thing to tackle?
Well, flooding in our area and in Kootenays more generally, you know, the peak flows are pretty much always in, you know, late spring, early summer, May, June time, although that can change with the change of climate with huge rain events in November, December, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it is connected for sure. The work that we do does look at the hydrology of the creeks and how they work, and change of climate affects that. It tends to move the peak flow earlier in the year. It can actually spread it out a little bit more into multiple peaks. It can be sort of argue sometimes better for flooding, but also we're getting more extreme events, as I think everyone realizes, in terms of patient events, especially, and there's nothing that our little community forest can do about that per se, other than, well, there's not nothing, but, you know, making sure that there's reasonable forest cover distributed on the hillsides in those events, and being precautionary with our roads, where they're located, how big the culverts are, how many culverts, all really nuts and bolts kind of things like that. But flooding is, yeah, flooding, you know, the houses in Harrop are all on the floodplain of historic floodplain of prehistoric floodplain of Harrop Creek. So Harrop was created through creek blowing out, and so was every other town on flat land in Kootenai Lake, right? That's what we're working with, is that creeks blow out and creeks move. We don't really want them to do that all that much anymore, but they're going to, and we have to make sure we don't make it worse. Right. And arguably, we could do limited things towards lowering those risks as well.
Right.
Through our forest management.
Yeah, well, that's awesome that you guys are like working on a plan and a pilot project to tackle those things, because obviously they're coming very fast. And it's so good to be proactive and to take those necessary steps so that you're still able to, you know, operate in the ways that you do, but also protecting the environment and adapting in a way that works with changes that are coming. Eric, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Is there any last couple of things you want to mention or talk about before we wrap up?
I will mention that I'm very fortunate to be able to work for the Kootenai Forest and to have a really interesting job, and to have have the mandate that I'd love to have, that I do love to have as a forester, a mandate that comes from the community and the organization. Not every forester, in fact, most foresters don't get that kind of a mandate as their mandate. So I recognize my personal great fortune in being able to do this and have a large amount of ownership with the community on what happens on the land and these watersheds. So I would be remiss if I didn't mention that. And that I'm learning things every week. You know, I started working for the Kootenai Forest in 2004, mm-hmm. right after the first wildfire, and we didn't know what to do about all of that back then, and we still don't know everything. But you know, it keeps evolving, and the general goals and principles can stay the same, but the methods and the techniques and have to keep evolving in order to keep up with our understanding of the ecosystems and to keep up with, you know, a changing community as well. There's new people moving to the community. There's always work to do in discussing what the objectives of our community forest are. And so it's always changing on that side too. Right. So it's very dynamic, which is great.
Yeah, and how can people support you? So can anybody become a member, or is it usually members or only those living in like the Harrop Proctor community, or?
Membership in the co-op is limited to, by design, to the residents of Harrop and Proctor.
Okay.
Because the organization has a mandate to protect that water. So anyone who owns land or lives in Harrop Proctor can be a lifetime member for $25. As far as being involved or supporting, we do have events and things where we invite the broader community to come. We also have a sawmill that sells lumber and to the Kootenai area more generally. So, you know, one way to support the community forest is to come and see what we have for sale down at our mill. And that's, you know, that's one way to, you know, put your money where your mouth is in terms of the products that you use. Our products, our prices are fairly, they're competitive. And they're specific products that, you know, you don't come to us to buy the 2x4s to frame your house. That's not
okay.
You know, we have, but if you have, you know, if you want some siding or decking or fencing or custom timbers or all those sorts of things. So that's another very concrete thing that people can do. And they can become members of the Harrop Proctor Watershed Protection Society. I don't believe membership of that organization is limited to residents of Harrop Proctor.
Okay,
so cool. That's our sister organization.
Thank you so much, Eric. That was really awesome. And thanks for sharing so much about the Harrop Proctor Community Co-op. And I encourage everybody listening to check them out. I know you have a really awesome website too that outlines more of the stuff you do.
You're welcome. Yeah, and on our website there are links to, you know, we have some videos that we've produced on community wildfire protection that are up there on YouTube, and we have a number of other things that if people want to learn more, they can find them via our website.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of the Lake. Stay updated on what we've been up to. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Friends of Kootenai Lake. Read our blog posts at friendsofkootenailake.ca and sign up to our monthly newsletter. Huge thanks to our funders, the Regional District of Central Kootenai and Fortis BC, for helping us bring these stories to you. Again, you're listening to The River by Born on a Wednesday. You can hear more music from Born on a Wednesday on Spotify, Bandcamp, or visit their website, bornonawednesday.com. Thanks so much. Brown hair and a short little skirt, bare feet.